Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, January 12th, 2025. We begin with the Science News double issue, December 14th, December 28th, 2024. The 2024 year in review. Looking back on the year in science, a few things seemed inescapable. Oppressive heat waves, viral outbreaks, the surging popularity of generative artificial intelligence. These events may seem disparate, but they have something in common: global warming. This year's record high temperatures wouldn't have been possible without human-caused climate change. Heat waves upended people's daily lives, while longer-term warming supercharged the spread of dengue and other mosquito-borne diseases, resulting in record numbers of infections this year. You might wonder how generative AI fits in. For all its promise, this energy-intensive technology produces a lot of climate-warming carbon emissions. Researchers are now asking whether the technology's purported benefits are worth the environmental cost. The path to more sustainable AI and a more climate-friendly future isn't straightforward, but it isn't impossible, and scientists are working on solutions. Other highlights in 2024 remind us there's still plenty of joy and wonder to be found in the world. Space missions revealed new details about our planetary neighbors. Archaeologists dug up dirt on human ancestors, and charismatic critters charmed our socks off. This summary, presented by Cassie Martin, the Deputy Managing Editor of Science News. First-of-a-kind feats in 2024. Each year, scientists break new ground in their quest to understand life and the mysteries of the cosmos. Here are seven milestones in 2024 that caught our attention. By Sophie Hartley. First, reading a fruit fly's mind. The first complete map of a fruit fly's brain details all 139,255 nerve cells and the 54.5 million connections between them. It's the largest brain map made of any animal, even though the fruit fly's brain is poppy seed-sized. The map could lead to a deeper understanding of how information flows in the brain. Next, nuclear timekeeping. Scientific clockmakers debuted the world's first prototype nuclear clock. While the prototype isn't a fully operational timepiece, its development showed scientists the precise frequency of light required to set off fluctuations in the energy levels of atomic nuclei. Next, new nitrogen factory. A eukaryote has joined some bacteria and archaea in the nitrogen fixation club. A type of marine alga has an internal factory that transforms nitrogen into ammonia, a biologically usable form. The factory probably started as a separate life form that entered a symbiotic relationship with the eukaryote. Over millennia, the two may have become so intertwined that they became one organism. Next, ultra-rare decay. By smashing protons into a fixed target, physicists witnessed a predicted, but never before confirmed, form of particle decay. The collision produced subatomic particles called kaons. These kaons decayed into an uncommon combination of three other types of particles at a rate of about 13 in 100 billion times. Continued investigation into the decay might help unveil new physics. Next, recycling dead weight. The tree fern is the first plant known to turn its dead leaves into roots. The leaves sprout rootlets, which the fern may use to search out nutrients in the soil of Panamanian forests. This particular tree fern is Cyathea rojasiana. Next, black hole awakening. In a sleepy galaxy not too far away, a supermassive black hole appears to be gradually waking up, providing astrophysicists with their first peek of a black hole transitioning from dim and quiet to bright and active. When supermassive black holes consume materials such as stars, they usually glow for only a few days to weeks. But lucky for scientists, this black hole has remained luminous for years. While researchers are not completely certain why the black hole continues to glow, they're following the situation closely and hoping to glean some insights into how black holes grow. And a picture of a panda reminds us that for the first time, researchers transformed the skin cells of giant pandas into stem cells that can be coaxed into any other type of cells in the body. Being able to take skin cells and end up with, say, the precursors of sperm and egg cells gives conservationists a leg up in defending the bears from extinction by boosting breeding. These first-of-a-kind feats come from the double issue of Science News, December 14th, December 28th, 2024. This 2024 year in review next focuses on the toll of 2024's heat. Scorching temperatures across the world set troubling new records. This is what it felt like, by Carolyn Gramling and Nick Ogasa. Over and over, the numbers tell the same story. 2024 was Earth's hottest year on record, knocking the previous record holder, 2023, out of the top spot. But temperatures alone can't describe the human cost, humidity that challenges the body's ability to cool itself, nighttime temperatures that rob people of sleep, power outages, wildfire smoke, ruined crops, rising cases of mosquito-borne disease. Meanwhile, record-breaking water temperatures in the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico fueled hurricanes Helene and Milton. Helene's torrential rains caused flooding across six states in the U.S. Southeast, killing over 200 people. Other parts of the world have their own stories to tell about the impact of 2024's extreme heat. Here are some of these accounts. 1. Phoenix, May-September. Arizona's capital experienced 113 straight days of daytime temperatures topping 100 degrees Fahrenheit, with hundreds of heat-related deaths recorded. Phoenix has one of the world's largest urban heat island magnitudes. City temperatures are about 12 degrees higher than those in surrounding rural areas. 2. Mexico City, May-June. An extreme heat wave on top of an extended drought caused blackouts and was linked to over 120 deaths. The resulting water scarcity raised fears that North America's largest metropolis was just weeks from day zero, a theoretical day when the region would run out of water. 3. Sao Paulo, August-September. Extreme heat in the southern hemisphere's winter plus prolonged drought fueled wildfires in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. Fine particles in Sao Paulo's air were 14 times the World Health Organization's recommended limit, causing the city to be ranked as the world's most polluted for four consecutive days, from September 9th to September 12th. 4. Rio de Janeiro, March. During a heat wave in Brazil, the maximum measured temperature reached 107.6 degrees Fahrenheit, but it felt even hotter. The heat index, a measurement that also includes humidity, soared to a record 144.1 degrees Fahrenheit, testing the limits of humans' heat tolerance. 5. Paris, July-August. Temperatures during the Olympics may not have broken records, but they were still scorching. Without climate change, Paris would have been about 5 degrees cooler, researchers determined. That made the Games more dangerous for athletes. Europe is the world's fastest warming continent, heating at a rate twice the global average. 6. Longyearbyen, July-August. August temps in the world's northernmost settlement on Norway's Spitsbergen Island were the highest ever recorded for that month, soaring to 68 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 3 degrees higher than the previous report set in 1997. In July, ice caps there broke the all-time record for daily melting, losing ice at a rate 5 times the norm. 7. Bamako, February-April. Heat waves across West Africa's Sahel region caused power cuts and spikes in hospital admissions. From April 1st to April 4th, a hospital in Mali's capital recorded a total of 102 deaths. The previous year, the hospital noted 130 deaths for all of April. Climate change amped up daytime highs by 2.7 degrees and kept nights 3.6 degrees warmer than usual. 8. Gaza in April. A three-day heat wave exacerbated the humanitarian crisis in Palestine. Nearly 2 million displaced people in refugee camps and overcrowded shelters lacked protection from the heat and faced water and food shortages, power outages, limited access to health care, and spikes in waterborne diseases. 9. Delhi in May-June. India's capital territory endured 40 straight days of daytime highs reaching 104 degrees, with a new record set on May 28th of 121.8 degrees Fahrenheit. The unrelenting heat killed over 100 people, the nonprofit organization HeatWatch India estimates. 10. Manila in April. The Philippines' megalopolis of over 14 million people sweltered through a deadly 15-day heat wave, an event that would have been impossible without climate change. The heat brought water shortages, crop losses, and school closures. And number 11, East Antarctica in July. At winter's peak, temperatures across a big chunk of the continent hovered at minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit, about 50 degrees higher than normal. The event was the largest temperature anomaly anywhere this year. Next, a look at artificial intelligence in the article entitled Power Hungry by Lauren Leffer. Is the promise of generative AI enough to justify its vast and growing energy consumption? It might seem like magic. Type a request into ChatGPT, click a button, and presto. Here's a five-paragraph analysis of Shakespeare's Hamlet, and as an added bonus, it's written in iambic pentameter. Or tell DALL-E about the chimeric animal from your dream, and out comes an image of a gecko-wolf-starfish hybrid. If you're feeling down, call up the digital ghost of your deceased grandmother and receive some comfort. Despite how it may appear, none of this materializes out of thin air. Every interaction with a chatbot or other generative AI system funnels through wires and cables to a data center, a warehouse full of server stacks that pass these prompts through the billions and potentially trillions of parameters that dictate how a generative model responds. Processing and answering prompts eats up electricity, as does the supporting infrastructure like fans and air conditioning that cool the whirring servers. In addition to big utility bills, the result is a lot of climate-warming carbon emissions. Electricity generation and server cooling also suck up tons of water, which is used in fossil fuel and nuclear energy production, and for evaporative or liquid heat dissipation systems. This year, as the popularity of generative AI continued to surge, environmentalists sounded the alarm about this resource-hungry technology. The debate over how to weigh the costs against the less tangible benefits that generative AI brings, such as increased productivity and information access, is steeped in ideological divisions over the purpose and value of technology. Advocates argue this latest revolution in AI is a societal good, even a necessity, that's bringing us closer than ever to artificial general intelligence, hyper-capable computer systems that some argue could be a paradigm-shifting technology, on par with the printing press or the internet. Generative AI is an accelerator for anything you want to do, says Rick Stevens, an associate lab director at Argonne National Laboratory and a computer scientist at the University of Chicago. In his view, the tech has already enabled major productivity gains for businesses and researchers. One analysis found 40% gains in performance when skilled workers used AI tools, he notes. AI assistants can boost vocabulary learning in schools, he adds, or help physicians diagnose and treat patients, and improve access to medical information, says Charlotte Blees, an interdisciplinary researcher at Uppsala University in Sweden, who studies health data. Generative AI might even help city planners cut down on traffic and reduce carbon emissions in the process, or help government agencies better forecast the weather, says Priya Donti, an electrical engineer and computer scientist at MIT and co-founder of the nonprofit Climate Change AI. The list goes on. Now, at this critical juncture, experts from fields as varied as economics, computer engineering, and sustainability are working to assess the true burden of the technology. How much energy does AI consume? ChatGPT and other generative tools are power-hungry, says Alex DeVries, founder of the research and consulting agency DigiEconomist and a PhD candidate at Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam. The larger you make these models, the more parameters, the more data, the better they perform. But of course, bigger also requires more computational resources to train and run them, requiring more power, says DeVries, who studies the environmental impact of technologies like cryptocurrency and AI. Bigger is better works for generative AI, but it doesn't work for the environment. Training generative AI models to spit out an analysis of Shakespeare or the image of a fantastical animal is costly. The process involves developing an AI architecture, amassing and storing reams of digital data, and then having the AI system ingest and incorporate that data, which can amount to everything publicly available on the internet, into its decision-making processes. Honing models to be more human-like and avoid unsafe responses takes additional effort. All told, training a single model uses more energy than 100 U.S. homes in a year. Querying ChatGPT uses about 10 times as much energy as a standard online search, according to the International Energy Agency. Composing an email with an AI chatbot can take 7 times as much energy as fully charging an iPhone 16, some researchers estimate. Though training is clearly a big resource suck, when millions of people rely on chatbots for everyday tasks, it adds up, says Xiaole Ren, an electrical and computer engineer at the University of California, Riverside. So much so that the AI sector could soon draw as much energy annually as the Netherlands, DeVries estimated in 2023 in the journal Joule. Given generative AI's rapid growth, the current trajectory already exceeds the prediction. And that's just electricity. 10 to 50 ChatGPT queries use half a liter of water, per a 2023 analysis by Wren and colleagues. That turned out to be a big underestimate too, he says, off by a factor of 4. Some engineers and AI experts dispute these numbers. I don't understand what the science is behind these estimates, says David Patterson, an engineer at Google and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. The only way I can imagine getting an accurate answer could be with close cooperation with a company like Google. Right now, that's impossible. Tech companies release limited information about their data centers and AI models, says DeVries and Wren. So it's hard to precisely assess the cradle-to-grave cost of AI or predict the future. In their estimates, both researchers relied on proxies, such as AI server production numbers from the tech company NVIDIA, or combining knowledge on data center locations with info from corporate sustainability reports. Real-world trends, however, do point to AI's voracious energy appetite. For decades before the generative AI boom, efficiency gains have compensated for the growing energy demand that comes with expansions in data centers and computing, says Andrew Chin, a computer scientist at the University of Chicago. That's changed. By the end of 2020, data center expansion began to outpace efficiency improvements, he says. Both Google's and Microsoft's self-reported energy usage more than doubled between 2019 and 2023. ChatGPT's release at the end of 2022 kickstarted a generative AI frenzy exacerbating the issue, Chen says. Before 2022, total energy demand in the U.S. had been stable for about 15 years. Now it's rising. The easiest way to save energy is not to do anything, Patterson says, but progress involves investment and costs. Generative AI is a very young technology, and stopping now would stymie its potential, he argues. It's too early to know that generative AI won't more than compensate the investment. A more sustainable path for AI. The decision need not be between shutting down generative AI development entirely or allowing it to continue unrestrained. Instead, most experts note there's a more responsible way to approach the technology, mitigating the risks and maximizing the rewards. Policies requiring companies to disclose where and how they're using generative AI, as well as the corresponding energy consumption, would be a step in the right direction, says Lynn Keck, a computer scientist and public policy expert at the Hertie School in Berlin. Regulating uses of the technology and access to it may prove difficult, but Keck says that's key to minimizing environmental and social harm. Perhaps not everyone, for instance, should be able to freely produce voice clones and photorealistic images with a single click. Should we pour the same amount of resources into supporting a generative meme machine as we do for running a hurricane forecasting model? More research into the tech's limitations could also save lots of futile consumption. AI is very powerful in certain kinds of applications, but completely useless in others, CAC says. Meanwhile, data centers and AI developers could take steps to lessen their carbon emissions and resource use, Chen says. Simple changes like training models only when there's ample carbon-free power on the grid, say on sunny days when solar panels produce an excess of energy, or subtly reducing system performance at times of peak energy demand, might make a measurable difference. Replacing water-intensive evaporative cooling with liquid immersion cooling or other closed-loop strategies that allow for water recycling would also minimize demand. Each of these choices involves trade-offs. Maybe more carbon-efficient systems generally use more water, Wren says. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. The alternative to exploring and incentivizing these options, even if they make it marginally harder for companies to develop ever bigger AI models, is risking part of our collective environmental fate, he says. There's no reason to believe that technology is going to save us, Chen says, so why not hedge our bets? This article, Power Hungry, A Review of AI, is part of Science News' 2024 Year in Review. Now we turn to advances in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. First, from the Department of Biomechanics, Goofy Running. A silly-looking strategy lets birds pick up the pace. When humans want to move fast, barring speed-walking races, we pick up our feet. But when birds need to get somewhere quickly without flying, they tend to always keep one foot on the ground, leading to a strange-looking gait that scientists call grounded running. Most people won't even probably realize that they've seen a bird use grounded running, says Pasha von Bijlert, an evolutionary biomechanics graduate student at Utrecht University and Naturalis Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands. Some of the times that you see a bird walking in a weird way, they're actually not walking, they're running. You can tell from the fact that they're bouncing. Grounded running in birds has puzzled scientists because humans mimicking the behavior usually use quite a bit more energy to achieve a running pace than we do with our habitual rapid movement style, called aerial running. But research by von Bijlert and his colleagues in Science Advances finds that birds aren't foolish for using grounded running, even though they may look silly. For the study, the scientists use a computer model of a common emu to show that the bird's posture makes grounded running more efficient than aerial running at certain speeds. By varying virtual emu's leg muscle and tendon anatomy, the simulations showed two strategies for reducing energy expenditure during faster movement. either keeping legs relatively straight during the running cycle or keeping one foot on the ground as much as possible. Humans take the first route, but birds can't, so they use grounded running instead. Humans asked to run in a crouched position will instinctively switch to grounded running as well. Give it a try if you're interested. If we think about bird locomotion through a human lens, then grounded running seems like a really weird and kind of dumb way to do something because it seems really energetically costly, says Armida R. Manofsadeh at Yale University. It's actually a pretty smart thing to do when you have the anatomy of a bird. Von Bischlert says the research may also inform scientists' understanding of birds' long-lost ancestors, dinosaurs. He suspects that especially dinosaurs that are closer relatives of birds, such as the petite velociraptors, might have chased down their prey like nightmare agents of the Ministry of Silly Walks. But more simulations are needed to determine whether bipedal dinosaurs, including the fearsome Tyrannosaurus rex, also might have practiced grounded running. The scientist adds that she hopes the new research reminds scientists to be curious about how other species experience life on Earth. If we try to interpret the diversity of animal locomotion through a human-centric lens, she says, we are going to miss out on lots of really cool and equally viable ways of moving around the world. This article, Goofy Running, was posted by Megan Bartles. And from Neuroscience, Echo Chamber, brains can be trained to see sound. Human echolocation has at times allowed people to ride bikes or play basketball, despite being completely blind from a very young age. These echolocators typically perceive their environment by clicking sharply with their tongues and listening to differences in the sounds reflected off objects. Brain imaging studies reveal that expert echolocators display responses to sound in their brain's primary visual region, and researchers have speculated that long-term input deprivation could lead to visual regions being repurposed. There's been this strong tradition to think of the blind brain as different, that it's necessary to have gone through that sensory loss to have this neuroplasticity, says Laura Toller, a neuroscientist at Durham University in England. Toller co-led a 2021 study showing that both blind and sighted people could learn echolocation with just 10 weeks of training. For more recent work in the journal Cerebral Cortex, she and her colleagues examined the brain changes underlying these abilities. After training, both blind and sighted people displayed responses to echoes in their visual cortex, a finding that challenges the belief that primary sensory regions are wholly sense-specific. The researchers trained 14 sighted and 12 blind people for between 2 and 3 hours twice a week over 10 weeks. They started by teaching participants to produce mouth clicks, then trained them on 3 tasks. The first 2 involved judging the size or orientation of objects. The 3rd involved navigating virtual mazes, which participants moved through with the help of simulated click plus echo sounds tied to their positions. Both groups improved on all the tasks. This study adds a significant contribution to a growing body of evidence that this is a trainable, non-exotic skill that's available to both blind and sighted people, says Santani Deng, a psychologist at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute in San Francisco, who studies echolocation and Braille. During brain scans before and after training, participants also performed a task that involved recognizing mazes, with and without click echoes. After training, both groups showed increased auditory cortex activation in response to sound in general, as well as higher gray matter density in auditory areas. Most surprisingly, after training, both blind and sighted participants also showed visual cortex activation in response to audible echoes. We weren't sure if we could get this result in sighted people, so it was really rewarding to see it, Toller says. She suspects that rather than just processing visual data, This brain area takes in information from varied senses that aid spatial understanding. 3 months after the 2021 study, a follow-up survey found that 83% of blind participants who had learned echolocation reported improvements in independence and well-being. The researchers are working on disseminating the training more widely, Toller says. It's a powerful sensory tool for people with vision impairments. This article written by Simon Macken. From the Department of Animal Behavior in Advances. Cultural construction. Culture may play a role in birds' nest architecture. From long and winding migration flights to intricate songs and clever tool use, many bird behaviors are known to be transmitted socially and persist across generations, what scientists define as animal culture. Now, a study suggests that culture may play a role in avian architecture, too. Researchers analyzed more than 400 structures built by 43 different groups of white-browed sparrow weavers in the Kalahari Desert in southern Africa. These birds live communally, and the entire cohort works together to build a nest and multiple roosts from grass. The group's dominant female then lays eggs in the nest, which has a long tube-like entrance. Individual birds slumber nearby in the U-shaped roosts, which have both an entrance and an exit. The scientists found that different gatherings of birds, even those living only a few meters from one another, built very different tube structures. The biggest difference was in how short or long the structures are, says study lead author Maria C. Tello Ramos, a cognitive ecologist at the University of Hull in England. Tube width also varied between groups. Furthermore, each group maintained the same architectural style over time, and when outsiders joined, they adapted to this style. To examine why the groups built differently, the team analyzed factors that can determine a nest size and shape for a given bird species: weather conditions, tree height, individual's body size, and genetic relatedness. If closely related birds build similar structures, for instance, one might assume a genetic element. Yet none of these factors seem to play a relevant role in shaping how the Kalahari sparrows built their nests, the researchers reported in the journal Science. Then we say, okay, so what is left? Tello Ramos explains. She and her colleagues proposed that cultural transmission might be key to nest building. In our paper, we haven't gotten there yet with experiments, but we have very good clues that that might be it, she says. These are important questions that are understudied, says Christina Riehl, an evolutionary biologist at Princeton University. She's not convinced the study's data are enough to fully rule out genetic influence. They can't really look at the effect of, say, genetic differences, because they don't really have good genetic information on all the individuals in these groups, she says. I think there's a lot left to be done, and I think this paper will inspire future research in a really good way. This article posted by Gennaro Toma. And from the Department of Robotics, Mushroom Power, Fungal Sensors Guide Robots. The fungal network hidden under fleshy white king oyster mushrooms doesn't just sprout elegant appetizers. It can also serve as a keen robotic sensor, helping to pilot a wheeled bot and a squishy, star-shaped hopping one. Oyster mushrooms' root-like mycelial threads generate voltage spikes when flashed with ultraviolet light. In an experiment for Science Robotics, researchers used this process to direct fungal tendrils grown in a petri dish to activate robots' motors via attached electrodes. These bots join a family of machines known as biohybrids. Successes so far range from a silicone-based jellyfish that uses cardiac cells to propel itself in water to a two-legged robot powered by laboratory-grown skeletal muscle. Most of these efforts use animal tissue in place of the mechanical motors. The new study uses a radically different organism's superpowers and thus expands engineers' toolboxes, says Rashid Bashir, a biohybrid researcher at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, who was not involved with the new study. Fungi are inexpensive to maintain and excel at detecting subtle shifts, not only in light, but also in nutrients and gases, such as carbon dioxide and ammonia, says senior study author Robert F. Shepard, an engineer at Cornell University. Shepard dreams of agricultural uses for fungi-powered bots, machines that harvest ripe fruit, for instance, or add nitrogen to arid soil. His team began with light sensing for a simpler proof-of-concept experiment. Translating a signal into motion for the rolling and starfish-shaped bots presented its own challenges. Beyond their electrical reaction to light, fungi produce a baseline current as they digest sugar. For the study, lead author Anand Kumar Mishra, also at Cornell, experimented with both minimizing and exploiting this extra information. In the latter case, robots reacted to all signals but moved faster in response to those prompted by UV light, which were larger. Mishra imagines that this model could come in handy for robots that might need to stop, slow down, or switch directions in response to nitrogen-deficient pockets in agricultural fields. In future work, Shepard and Mishra hope to grow fungi throughout their robots so the devices can sense light or chemicals from every direction. If wired a particular way, the robots could also respond to these stimuli locally. Fungus-controlled fruit pickers, for example, might extend multiple arms to the locations of different ripe peaches. The scientists will also investigate the longevity of the fungal tendrils. For now, Shepard and Mishra are just glad that the proof-of-concept experiment succeeded. "We really had no idea where to start," Mishra explains, "because these robots were the first of their kind. It took the team 3 years to design one that could startle in response to UV light. Watching the mechanical starfish scamper across the table for the first time, Shepard himself felt keenly alive." This article posted by Saima S. Iqbal. Now to book reviews from the same issue of Scientific American. First, a review of Oak Origins, From Acorns to Species and the Tree of Life, by Andrew L. Hipp, illustrated by Rachel D. Davis, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2024. This review is written by Dana Dunham. In many parts of the world, if you take a walk in the woods, you are likely to encounter an oak tree. With 425 species worldwide, their collective abundance may lead one to believe these trees are somewhat unremarkable, a fixture we take for granted. But Andrew L. Hipp, a botanist and research director at the Morton Arboretum in Illinois, reveals that oaks are a dynamic and essential part of the forest. Oaks have been on naturalists' radar for some time. In On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin highlighted European oaks as an example of species variation. The advent of DNA technology, though, offered a sharp new lens on what Hipp calls one of oaks' superpowers, their ability to breed with other oak species while still maintaining some of their original genetic qualities. After oaks first appeared, 56 million years ago, they expanded their range, adapting to diverse environments through natural selection. They began to diverge into distinct species at least 45 million years ago. Yet a California scrub white oak can reproduce with an Engelmann oak. Hipp contrasts this knack with humans' inability to procreate with chimpanzees, even though our evolutionary split was far more recent. Oaks' capacity to hybridize without merging brings out fascinating nuances in the so-called tree of life. This visual metaphor separates species into distinct branches. But look closely at the oak's section, Hipp says, and you will find strands of gossamer trailing between the branches, genes moving between lineages. He gently guides readers through these complexities, laying the groundwork for lucid explanations about the tree's evolution and biology. In one analogy, he compares oaks' prodigious potential for genetic recombination with the extensive post-production tape splicing that created Miles Davis's song, Pharaoh's Dance. Oaks are primed with genetic flexibility that allows them to solve ecological problems, but the current rise in global temperatures far outpaces its faster previous climb, posing a problem even these protean adapters cannot solve without human intervention. Hip's work shows that conserving oak species will preserve invaluable nodes in our genetic web. There are many things we can learn from trees, particularly tree rings. In this New York Times trilobite posted on July 10, 2024, we learn about centuries of avalanches that are stored in tree rings. Discovering evidence of deadly deluges of snow from the past could help protect people on mountains around the world, researchers say. A rumble, a deluge of snow, and then silence. Avalanches can be deadly, but they often leave behind little enduring evidence of their passage. Now, researchers have turned to tree rings to reconstruct records of avalanches past. By analyzing the wood of hundreds of living pine trees near a ski resort in Bulgaria, a team of scientists found evidence of dozens of large avalanches that struck the area over two centuries. Understanding the frequency of potentially destructive avalanches can inform risk management efforts and land use planning, the researchers suggest. They published their results in the journal Dendrochronologia in June of this year. The Piran Mountains in southwestern Bulgaria are home to old-growth forests of pine and fir trees. Many of the trees have been standing for centuries, but some have steeply leaning trunks, while others bear conspicuous scars, such as broken branches, said Momchil Panayotov, one of the authors of the study, and a dendrochronologist at the University of Forestry in Sofia, Bulgaria. That damage, many researchers believe, was inflicted by avalanches. The mechanical impact of snow rushing downslope can severely damage a large tree and even uproot it entirely. But visible damage doesn't reveal when exactly an avalanche occurred, which is important information for reconstructing records of the dangerous events. To determine when and where avalanches have occurred in the Pirin Mountains, Dr. Panayotov and Nikolay Tsvetanov, also an author of the study and a dendrochronologist at the University of Forestry, turned to tree rings. Trees that experience an avalanche develop telltale signs in their rings, Dr. Panayotov said. The survivors keep the record. In 2020 and 2021, Dr. Panayotov, Dr. Tsvetanov, and several students collected samples of wood from hundreds of pine trees in the Piran Mountains that had signs of damage. The team focused on three known avalanche corridors in the Bundaritsa Valley, home of the Bansko Ski Resort. The researchers used an instrument called an increment borer to manually extract pencil-width cores from each living tree. Back in the laboratory, Dr. Tsvetanov dried the cores, mounted them in wooden holders, and then sanded them down to reveal individual rings. It's a very long process, he said. The team then compared those tree ring records with sequences of rings obtained from nearby, undamaged trees. That cross-dating allowed the researchers to pinpoint the timing of unexpected features like suppressed growth, scars, and missing rings. Trees are amazing recorders of past disturbances, including geomorphic hazards such as snow avalanches, said Allison Carroll, a dendrochronologist at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, who was not involved in the research. To determine when and where avalanches have occurred in the Pirin Mountains, Dr. Panayotov and Dr. Tsvetanov found evidence of avalanches that took place as far back as the 1600s. But definitively concluding that an avalanche occurred that long ago is challenging, Dr. Panayotov said, as relatively few avalanche-affected trees survive for centuries. The team therefore opted to focus on more recent avalanches. The researchers inferred that over 20 large avalanches had occurred since the mid-1800s. Some of those events can be linked to historical records. For instance, the avalanche that appears in tree rings dating to 1963 is probably a documented event that occurred on February 12th of that year. But other avalanches seemingly rolled downhill into oblivion. We don't have written histories of these events, Dr. Panayotov said. We can only rely on tree rings. By analyzing the spatial positions of the affected trees, the researchers could also estimate the approximate size of each avalanche. For example, they found that the avalanche that occurred in 1969 was unusually large. It reached high up one of the corridor's banks. The team also noted that avalanches struck across all three corridors in 1963 and across two corridors in 1931, 1987, and 1996. There was some specific meteorological situations that favored big avalanches in those years, Dr. Panayotov said, like strong storms in the wintertime. But reliably predicting that avalanches are more likely in certain climatic conditions will require more data. You need time series that reach farther back in time to get good correlations between climatic conditions and avalanches, said Marcus Stoffel, an environmental scientist at the University of Geneva who was not involved in the research. Dr. Panayotov and Dr. Svetanov hope that their results will contribute to keeping winter sports enthusiasts safe. Both researchers have a vested interest. Dr. Svetanov is a snowboarder, and Dr. Panayotov is a skier who participates in mountain rescue efforts and helps oversee avalanche education and safety at the Bansko Ski Resort. "I'm a regular over there," he said. And this New York Times trilobite, "Centuries of Avalanches Are Stored in Tree Rings," was posted on July 10, 2024, and written by Catherine Cornet. Next, from the New York Times, posted on October 19, 2024. Reinventing Concrete, the Ancient Roman Way. By learning the secrets of 2,000-year-old cement, researchers are trying to devise greener, more durable, modern options. By Amos Zeeberg. In June, the Italian Ministry of Culture announced the excavation of a new room, not yet open to the public, in the ruins of Pompeii. A few weeks later, a group of archaeologists gathered to marvel at it. Walls covered with bright blue paint, an expensive pigment reserved for special rooms, and detailed frescoes of agricultural images, remarkably well-preserved after almost 2,000 years. Admir Basich, a chemist at MIT, was more captivated by what appeared, to an unschooled guest, like an unremarkable pile of sandy dirt at the edge of the room. The material, light tan and granular, had been a critical component of the Roman Empire, he said, the precursor to concrete, a mainstay of Roman infrastructure, including the aqueducts that brought fresh water to cities like Pompeii. "They managed to bring water to the city, and with water came hygiene," Dr. Masich said. "That technological advance allowed them to, first of all, build Rome as it is, but also replicate this anywhere they would go." He spread his arms as if circumscribing the entire Roman world. Modern concrete, based on a material known as Portland cement, was developed in England in the 19th century and is the world's most popular building material by far. It is cheap, strong, and standardized, providing engineers everywhere with an easy material for building apartments, dams, skyscrapers, and more. But it is much less resilient than the concrete used in Roman times. Over the course of decades, it develops cracks that, by letting water in, can eventually destroy the material. Moreover, the manufacture of concrete is a major driver of climate change, producing 8% of carbon dioxide emissions worldwide. By learning these secrets of Roman concrete, researchers like Dr. Masich can try to devise greener, more durable, modern options. Roman marine concretes have survived in one of the most aggressive environments on Earth, with no maintenance at all, said Marie Jackson, a geologist at the University of Utah. A self-healing substance. Roman concrete derives much of its strength from a mixture of calcium aluminate, silicate, hydrates, known as CASH, C-A-S-H, with different chemical formulas. But exactly how the Romans produced that material is not clear. The traditional belief is that Romans heated limestone, mostly made of calcium carbonate, to produce a dangerously reactive material called quicklime or calcium oxide. Then they added water, forming calcium hydroxide or slaked lime. Finally, they combined this with a bulky material, often volcanic ash, which supplied the aluminum and silicon necessary for the concrete, the A and S in CASH. Dr. Masich sees a problem with this explanation. Many examples of Roman concrete, he noted, contain visible white chunks or clasts. You see these everywhere, in Rome, in Africa, in Israel, he said. The chunks are typically thought to be unintentional products of poor workmanship, but Dr. Masich maintains that Roman engineers were too clever to consistently make concrete riddled with mistakes. People said lime clasts are bad mixing of slaked lime, he said. Our hypothesis is it's not part of bad processing. It's part of the technology. According to Dr. Masich's research, these lime clasts were actually reservoirs of calcium that helped fill in cracks, making the concrete self-healing. As cracks formed, water would seep in and dissolve the calcium in the lime, which then formed solid calcium carbonate, essentially creating new rock that filled in the crack. Dr. Masich contends that the lime clasts came not from slaked lime, but from quicklime that Romans added directly, a process called hot mixing. Since quicklime is so reactive, it generates heat when combined with volcanic ash, warming the material to over 170 degrees Fahrenheit, making the concrete harden much faster. The technique also generated some hot spots of almost 400 degrees, causing some of the quicklime to remain in small, intact chunks. The clasts, seen in Roman concrete today, that provide its self-healing properties, Dr. Masich said. But it's hard to prove that the Romans intentionally left chunks of quicklime in their concrete, because the chunks changed chemically over the centuries. By examining the clasts with special microscopes, Dr. Masich said, he and his colleagues have shown that the clasts indeed started out as quicklime. Dr. Masich has spun off his research into a company called DMAT, which aims to integrate the principles of Roman concrete chemistry into the modern version. It sells an additive that claims to seal cracks in concrete, which in theory would reduce the reliance on Portland cement, with its big carbon footprint. We generate more strength, generate more binding agent, said Paolo Sabatini, the company's chief executive. When we do that, we use less concrete. Volcanic reactions. Not all researchers are convinced that hot mixing was the key to the Romans' self-healing concrete. Dr. Jackson contends, instead, that the secret lay in the bulky materials that were mixed with lime, often a type of volcanic ash called pozzolana. Named after the seaside town of Pozzuoli, Italy, where much of it was excavated, pozzolana activated special chemical reactions that lent Roman concrete its unmatched durability, according to her research. The initial reaction of lime and pozzolana generated the CASH compounds that acted as the glue in ancient Roman concrete, and the materials continued reacting, forming rare minerals like stretlingite for many years after the concrete was made, Dr. Jackson found. The stretlingite crystals, shaped like flakes and needles, helped bond together rough chunks of material in the concrete and blocked the growth of cracks. This toughening of the concrete seems to be critical to the long-term resilience, she said, and contributes to reinforcing cohesion over the centuries. Dr. Jackson and her collaborators have tested their hypotheses about ancient concrete by creating modern analogs of it. In one experiment, the researchers built concrete arches, submerged them in seawater for 50 days, and then pushed the top of the arches with increasing pressure until the concrete started to bend and crack. Then the arches were submerged for almost a year and tested again. The researchers found that cache compounds had filled the tiny cracks and that the arches could withstand 2 to 3 times as much force as before, depending on the particular test. Then the team submerged the arches once more. Later this month, they plan to test them again after almost 3 years in seawater. The way Romans chose the materials actually blocked the propagation of fractures, Dr. Jackson said. They were the masters. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.